last time we studied Paul's salutation at the beginning of the Epistle to the Galatians in the first 5 verses, in which he writes both of himself and of Jesus Christ. He describes his own status as an apostle, not from men nor through man, but through Jesus Christ and God the Father. And then he describes the death of Christ, who gave himself for our sins to deliver us from this present evil age. In every other epistle of Paul, after greeting his readers, he goes on to pray for them, or to praise and thank God. In the Epistle to the Galatians only, there is no prayer, no praise, no thanksgiving, and no commendation. Instead, he plunges at once into his theme with a note of extreme urgency. He expresses astonishment at the fickleness, the instability of the Galatians. He complains about the false teachers who are troubling the Galatian churches. And then he utters a most solemn, fearful anathema upon those who dare to change the gospel. First then, we consider the unfaithfulness of the Galatians, verses 6 and the beginning of verse 7. "I am astonished," he says, "that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ." You are removed, which is the authorized version, is misleading in two respects. The verb should be active, not passive, because it's in the middle voice, and the tense should be present and not past. In other words, it's not "you are removed," but "you are deserting," or New English Bible, "you are turning so quickly away." The Greek word is an interesting one. Literally, it means to transfer one's allegiance. It's used of soldiers in the army who revolt or desert. And it's used of men who change sides in politics or in philosophy. Thus, a certain Dionysius of Heraclea, who left the Stoics and became a member of the rival philosophical school, an Epicurean, was called by this name, a turncoat. It is of this that Paul accuses the Galatians. They are religious turncoats, spiritual deserters. They're turning away from him who hath called them in the grace of Christ and embracing another gospel. The true gospel is essentially what Paul called it in Acts 20:24, the gospel of the grace of God, good news that is of the free and unmerited favor of God. The gospel is good news of a God who is gracious to undeserving sinners. In grace he gave his Son to die for us. In grace he calls us to himself. In grace he justifies us when we believe. All is of God, as Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians 5:18, which means that all is of grace. Nothing is due to our efforts or our merits or our works. Everything in salvation is due to the grace of God. But the Galatian converts, who had received this gospel of grace, were now turning away to another gospel, which was not another, for it was a gospel of works. We know that the false teachers were Judaizers, and we know what the Judaizers were teaching. It's summarized for us, for instance, in Acts 15, verse 1, where they said, "Unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved." Oh, you must believe in Jesus for salvation. They didn't deny this. But you must also be circumcised, and you must also keep the law. In other words, as Paul clearly saw, you must let Moses finish what Christ has begun. Christ's cross is all right as far as it goes, but it has to be supplemented by Moses' law. Or rather, to put it even more accurately, you yourself must finish, by your obedience to the law, what Jesus Christ has begun. You must add your works to the work of Christ. You must finish Christ's unfinished work. This doctrine, Paul will simply not tolerate. What? Add human merits to the merit of Christ? Add human works to the work of Christ? No, sir. The work of Christ is a finished work, and the gospel of Christ is a gospel of free grace. Salvation is by grace alone, through faith alone, without any admixture of human works or merits. It's due solely to God's gracious call, and not to any good works of our own. Paul goes even further than this. He says that the defection of the Galatian converts was in their experience as well as in their theology. He writes, you notice, not that they are deserting the gospel of grace for another gospel, but that they are deserting him who called them in grace. In other words, theology and experience, Christian faith and Christian life, belong together and cannot be divorced. To turn from the gospel of grace is to turn from the God of grace. Let the Galatians, who so readily and rashly begun to turn away, beware. It is impossible to forsake it, the gospel, without forsaking him, God. As he says later in Galatians 5:4, you have fallen away from grace. So much for the unfaithfulness of the Galatians. That brings us secondly to the activity of the false teachers, the end of verse 7. The reason why the Galatian converts were deserting him who called them in grace was that there are some that trouble you. The Greek verb to trouble there means to shake or agitate, and the Galatian congregations had been thrown by their false teachers into a state of turmoil, intellectual confusion on the one hand and warring factions on the other. It's rather interesting that the Council at Jerusalem, which I believe met just after Paul had written this epistle, were to use in the letter which they sent out to the churches the very same verb. This is Acts 15:24. We have heard, they wrote in this letter, that some persons from us have troubled you with words, unsettling your minds, although we gave them no instructions. That is, they came from the Jerusalem church, but they had no authority from the Jerusalem church. This trouble was caused by false doctrine. The Judaizers are trying to pervert authorized and revised standard versions, or distort New English Bible, the gospel. In J.B. Phillips' version, they were propagating a travesty of the gospel of Christ. As a matter of fact, the Greek word is even stronger still. It could be translated that they were trying to reverse the gospel. They were not just corrupting it, they were reversing it, turning it back to front and upside down. You cannot modify the gospel or supplement the gospel without changing it. Now please notice these two things which are told us about the false teachers. The first is that they're troubling the church, and the second is that they're changing the gospel. These two go together. To tamper with the gospel is always to trouble the church. You cannot touch the gospel and leave the church untouched, because the church is created by the gospel. The church lives by the gospel. Indeed, I must say that the church's greatest troublemakers, now as then, are not those outside who oppose and ridicule and persecute the church, but those inside who try to change the gospel. They trouble the church. Conversely, the only way to be a good churchman is to be a good gospel man. The best way to serve the church is to believe and preach the gospel. That brings me thirdly to the reaction of the Apostle Paul. The situation in the Galatian churches should, I think, by now be clear. The false teachers were distorting the gospel, and the Galatian converts were deserting the gospel. What was Paul's reaction to this situation? His first reaction was one of utter astonishment. Verse 6, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ. Many evangelists of later generations have been similarly astonished and distressed to see how quickly, how readily converts relapse their hold of the gospel, which they seemed to have so firmly embraced. It is, as he writes in chapter 3, verse 1, as if someone has bewitched them, as if someone has cast a spell over them. And this is in fact the case. The devil disturbs the church more by the insinuation of error than by the insinuation of evil. And when he cannot entice Christian people into sin, he deceives them with false doctrine. If Paul's first reaction was one of astonishment over the converts, his second reaction was indignation over the false teachers, upon whom he now pronounces a solemn curse. Look at verses 8 and 9. If we, or an angel from heaven, should preach to you a gospel contrary to that which we preach to you, let him be accursed. Verse 9. As we have said before, so now say I again, if anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to that which you received, let him be accursed. The word that is Christ translated accursed is the word anathema. It's a word used in the Greek Old Testament for the divine ban, the curse of God resting upon anything or anyone that he has devoted to destruction. You'll remember an example of this, if you know your Old Testament, in the story of Achan. For God had said that the spoil of the Canaanites that was under his ban, it was devoted to destruction. It was to be destroyed. It could not be stolen and used by the Israelites. But Achan stole some of it, and he kept for himself what God had devoted to destruction. So the Apostle Paul declares that these false teachers are under the divine ban or curse or anathema. Or, a little more accurately, he expresses the wish that God's judgment will fall upon them. And the Galatian churches, it is implied, will surely then not accord such teachers a welcome or a hearing. Surely they will now refuse to receive or to hear them, because they are men rejected by God. The teaching is really just the same as is given us by the Apostle John, the Apostle of Love, in his second epistle, verses 10 and 11. What are we to say about these verses 8 and 9? Are we to dismiss this as an intemperate outburst? Are we to reject it as a sentiment that is inconsistent with the Spirit of Christ and unworthy of the gospel of Christ? Are we to explain it away as the utterance of a man with the child of his age, and poor chap knew no better? Many people would think of these words in that way, but I do not. And I want to bring to you at least two considerations which will help us to recognize that this apostolic anathema was not the expression of personal venom towards rival teachers. And the first consideration is this: the curse of the apostle, or the curse of God that the apostle desires, is universal in its embrace. It rests upon any and every teacher who distorts the essence of the gospel and propagates his distortion. That's clear in verse 9. As we've said before, I say again, if anyone is preaching, and it's even more specific in the previous verse 8, there he applies it to angels. He says, if even an angel from heaven should preach a gospel, angels as well as men, and then he applies it to himself as well. He says, even if I, so disinterested is Paul's zeal for the gospel that he even desires the curse of God to fall upon him himself if he should be guilty of perverting it. Now that is the first and very important consideration. Paul's not being personal. There's no spite or animosity. This curse that he desires upon others, he desires upon himself if he should do the same thing. And then the second consideration that I bring you is this, that his curse is uttered deliberately and with a conscious responsibility to God. To begin with, it is repeated, which shows that it's deliberate in verses 8 and 9. And John Brown, the commentator of Edinburgh, writes, "The apostle repeats it to show the Galatians that this was no excessive, exaggerated statement into which passion had hurried him, but his calmly formed and unalterable opinion." And then the apostle goes on, verse 10, "Am I now seeking the favor of men or of God? Am I trying to please men? If I were still pleasing men, I should not be the servant of Christ." It seems clear that Paul's detractors were accusing him of being a time server, a men pleaser, who suited his message to his audience. But Paul says now, is this outspoken condemnation of the false teachers the language of a men pleaser? On the contrary, no man can serve two masters, and since Paul is first and foremost a servant of Jesus Christ, his great ambition is to please Christ and not men. It is therefore as a conscious servant of Jesus Christ, responsible to his divine Lord, that he measures his words and dares to utter the solemn anathema. Let us then remember these two considerations, that Paul uttered his curse impartially, whoever the teachers might be, even himself, and he uttered his curse deliberately, in the presence of Christ, and responsible to Christ his Lord. Still somebody will say, why did he feel so strongly? Why did he use such drastic language? Well, I'll tell you, there were clearly two reasons. The first is this, that the glory of Christ was at stake. To make men's works necessary to salvation, even as a supplement to the work of Christ, is derogatory to his finished work. It is to imply that Christ's work on the cross was unsatisfactory, and that men need to add to it or improve upon it in some way. But as Paul writes at the end of the next chapter, Galatians 2:21, if righteousness, if justification is through the law, if we are accepted before God through our obedience to the law, Christ died to no purpose. The glory of Christ is at stake. And then the second reason why he felt so strongly is that the good of men's souls is at stake also. You see, Paul is not writing about some trivial doctrine, but about something that is fundamental to the gospel. He's not even speaking of those who hold false views, but of those who teach them and so mislead others. We need to see that Paul cared deeply for the souls of men. Elsewhere, in Romans 9 at the beginning, he says that he's willing to be damned himself, if thereby others may be saved. Paul knew that the gospel of Christ is the power of God unto salvation, and therefore to corrupt the gospel is to destroy the way of salvation. And to destroy the way of salvation is to send to ruin souls who might have been saved by it. Did not Jesus himself have some very solemn words to say to those who cause others to stumble? Did he not speak of a millstone being hanged round people's necks and that they should be cast into the midst of the sea? It looks then as if Paul, far from contradicting the Spirit of Christ, was actually expressing it. I know very well that we live in an age in which it is considered very narrow-minded and very intolerant to have any clear or strong opinions of one's own, let alone to disagree sharply with anybody else. As for actually desiring that false teachers should fall under the curse of God and be treated as such by the church, why, the very idea is inconceivable to many people today. But I venture to say to you that if we cared more for the glory of Christ, And if we cared more for the souls of men and the good of the souls of men, we too would simply not be able to bear the corruption of the gospel of grace. So far, we have considered these three things: the unfaithfulness of the Galatian converts, the activity of the false teachers, and the reaction of the Apostle Paul. Now, what lesson are we to learn from all this? I tell you, the lesson we learn is that there is only one gospel. There is only one gospel. Oh, the popular view, I know, is that there are many different ways to God. The popular view is that the gospel changes with the passage of the years, so that you cannot condemn the gospel to fossilization in the first century AD. But no, there is only one gospel, and the gospel does not change. Any teaching that claims to be another gospel is not another. Paul uses two adjectives, as a matter of fact, and the Revised Standard Version brings it out rather well. It says that these Galatians were turning to a different gospel, not that there is another. In other words, there are different gospels being preached, but there are different gospels. There is not another. There isn't a second gospel, there's only one. And the message of the false teachers was not an alternative gospel. It was a perverted gospel. Well, somebody says, how can we recognize the true gospel? What are the marks of the one and only gospel? These marks are given us here. They concern its substance, what it is, and its source, where it comes from. Firstly, its substance. It is the gospel of grace, of the free and unmerited favor of God. And to turn from him who called you in the grace of Christ is to turn from the true gospel. Whenever teachers start exalting man, implying that man can contribute anything to his salvation by his own morality or religion or philosophy or respectability or any of his works or merits, then the gospel of grace is being corrupted. That's the first test. And the second concerns not the substance, but the source of the gospel, that it is the gospel of the apostles, of Jesus Christ, the gospel of the New Testament, in other words. Look again at verses 8 and 9. Even if we, or an angel from heaven, should preach to a gospel contrary to that which we preached and you received, let him be accursed. In other words, the norm, the criterion by which all human systems and opinions are to be tested is the primitive gospel, the gospel which the apostles preached and is now recorded in the New Testament. Any system other than Authorized Version, or contrary to Revised Standard Version, or at variance with New English Bible, that which the apostles preached, is to be rejected. That, as a matter of fact, is the teaching of the Church of England in Article 20, that the Church has no authority to decree anything against God's Word written, neither besides the same, that is, in addition to God's Word, may it require anything to be believed, etc. This, then, is a fundamental test. Anybody who rejects the apostolic gospel, no matter who he may be, is himself to be rejected. He may even appear as an angel from heaven, but in this case we are to prefer apostles to angels. We are not to be dazzled, as many people are, by the person or office of teachers in the church. They may come to us with great dignity. They may come to us with great authority. They may come to us with great scholarship. They may be bishops or archbishops, university professors, or even the Pope himself. But if they bring a gospel other than the gospel preached by the apostles and recorded in the New Testament, they are to be rejected. We judge them by the gospel. We do not judge the gospel by them. As Dr. Alan Cole has expressed it in his commentary, the outward person of the messenger does not validate his message. Rather, the nature of the message validates the messenger. So then, as we hear and read the multifarious opinions of men and women today, as they're broadcast and televised, let us subject them to these two rigorous tests. First, is this opinion consistent with the free grace of God? And second, is this consistent with the plain teaching of the New Testament? If not, reject it, however august the teacher may be. And if it is consistent with grace and with the apostolic teaching of the New Testament, then embrace it. Hold it fast. Do not desert it. Do not compromise it. Live by it yourself. And then seek by life and limb to make it known to others.